Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. Today, we're very, very fortunate to be joined by a guest who's got a lot of insight, not only into where things are lying politically in Alberta with what people's priorities are, but he's also done a fascinating breakdown, appropriately enough, on what conservatism is and what it means in Alberta. So we're very, very, very excited to have Dr. Jared Wesley, political scientist with U of A, joining us today. Dr. Wesley, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So to start with, I mean, we have sort of two broad topics that I want to touch on today. We're coming into this with just one, and then you made things more interesting today with some data that you posted through an initiative that you're part of, and I want to hit on that. But first, I really want to sort of spend some time on the big reason why we wanted to have you on the show in the first place, and that's because you've done some fascinating exploration of what conservatism means in Alberta and why, as people say, you could paint a rock blue and people would vote for it. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Give us some background on that.
Yeah, I've been studying conservatism in Alberta since the late 90s. And in some ways, a lot has changed, and in some ways, not a lot has changed. So a lot of people, when they think about conservatism, think of it as an ideology or a set of beliefs that include things like prioritizing the individual over the community, or making sure that we promote local interests over broader interests, and so on. And certainly conservatism, modern conservatism, which some people call neoliberalism, does have ideological connotations. But that doesn't help us to explain a lot about how conservatives, big C and small C, actually behave in Alberta. So our research has tried to look at conservatism not just as an ideology, but as a political culture, and meaning that Alberta as a community has a self-perception, and other people from outside the province have a perception of Alberta being conservative. And that idea of ourselves, the story that we tell ourselves about being conservative, affects the way that we interact with our political environment, affects the way we vote, affects all kinds of things. But as we'll talk about later, as you mentioned, we dropped some data earlier this week on how conservatism is actually also a basket or a bucket of priorities, right? So a lot of people look at conservatism in Alberta as being pro-oil and gas, or jobs, economy, and pipelines, as we heard repeatedly throughout the 2019 provincial campaign. If you tie all of these together, we've noted that conservatism is also part of a lot of Albertans' identity, maybe not their personal identity, but they tend to be able to, the idea of Alberta being a conservative community resonates with them, sometimes on a subconscious level. They could be progressive, but they also see their community as being conservative. So that's what our Common Ground Initiative is about, is trying to figure out how all of these different types of conservatism interact with one another.
Okay. So when we're talking about conservatism, it seems like, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like we're talking about a couple of different things. So when you say conservative in Alberta, that's kind of like saying pickup truck, in the sense that, yes, you know, there's an affinity for pickup trucks, but when you take a look at all the different types of pickup trucks that are out there, it can vary all the way from an 80s Chevy all the way up to a Tesla Cybertruck. And there's a lot of difference between all of those different types of truck, despite the fact that they all identify as a truck. So how would you sort of, you sent me an interesting little table, and I might see if I can figure out a way to throw it up on the screen so that our viewers can see it as well. But for our audio listeners, can you kind of walk us through what are the defining characteristics of conservatism as we see it under the UCP?
Well, again, our analysis is based on public opinion data dating back generations, but also an examination of political party platforms, conservative party platforms over time. So one of the key pillars of Alberta conservatism is an Alberta first mentality. The idea that Alberta is exceptional in some way, it's embodied in this notion of the Alberta advantage that's based on taxes, but other things as well. And we've seen politicians throughout Alberta history, conservative politicians, play on that idea of Alberta first, which is different from progressive view of Alberta, which suggests that Alberta is part of a larger Canadian community or a larger cosmopolitan community, right? Another pillar I'd point out, we're not going to go through all four, but the other pillar I think is really key to understanding Alberta conservatism is this notion of prosperity first, right? And this idea that prosperity is part of the Alberta dream, as some, as you say, trucks are an important part of Alberta identity. The one car ad talks about the Canadian dream in these kinds of in this kind of way as well. It was just play on the American dream. This notion that prosperity is good. It's something that we should strive for as a community and as individuals. And that if you are prosperous, that's seen as being the result of your hard work. And it's also seen as being a reward for that hard work. Now, the flip side of that is that if you aren't prosperous, it must mean that there's some kind of personal failing in you. You're not working hard enough, and that goodness was not bestowed on you. So this dates back generations to the to an old version, one version of prosperity doctrine that the Social Credit Party had managed to weave into their religious teachings as well. But we see it play out often in campaign messaging. In the 2019 Alberta election, we saw the UCP play up prosperity as well as a number of PACs who were supporting them. So I think those are the two most important pillars that help us to understand how Alberta conservatism is a bit different from the other types of conservatism we see across Canada, particularly in Atlantic Canada, where it's not as individualistic, but rather far more communitarian. And we refer to that as Tory conservatism.
Okay. So I want to sort of deconstruct both of those pillars a little bit. So with the Alberta first piece, I mean, Alberta is a part of Confederation. We're part of a country. And for many things, nowadays more so than historically, we're definitely reliant on the federal government for certain things. And definitely with the economic downturn, it's been suggested that we're going to see a lot more reliance on the federal government because we aren't going to be quite the have province that we used to be. We still will be a have province. That much is pretty much not up for debate because math. But there is a perception that Alberta is suffering more so than the rest of Canada, and whether or not that's factually accurate, I don't think is up for debate because facts are facts. But the notion that Alberta has to be first, to me, there's a real problem with scalability there. I mean, it's a great position because it allows you to say, oh, we're up against the rest of Canada and we got something that we got to fight for and yada yada yada. But it doesn't necessarily just scale up to my way of reasoning. It also scales down. So that allows for Albertans to say Northern Alberta first or Southern Alberta first, and then break down into municipalities and then break down into communities. And essentially, what it appears to me is that it creates a very oppositional culture as opposed to one of community building and going forward. What are your thoughts on that? Am I completely wrong or?
No, it happens at multiple levels. And I think that's what makes this generation of Western alienation very different from previous ones. Okay. Because in previous generations, like today, there's always a sense that the rest of Canada was holding us back, right? Whether it be through the National Energy Program or years before that, the national policy, somehow the West, in particular Alberta, was being held back by federal policies. That's still being felt today, although there is now a sense that it's not just the federal government, but these global forces that are beyond our control that are holding us back, right? We're talking about the environmental movement, the decline in demand for our natural resources, and so on. And there's that, but then there's also the fact that Albertans are not seeing themselves as leading the pack anymore, right? We've seen economic forecasts that have us in the middle, if not at the bottom, in terms of economic growth. That's been well before the COVID recession. And people have started to internalize that. When one of our Viewpoint Alberta surveys, for example, we found that for the first time, a majority of Albertans now feel like the province's best days are behind it, which suggests there's something completely different going on here. To your point about this existing on multiple levels, we have that community mentality that somehow we're being left behind. We see it at the, the meso level or the community level within towns like Fort McMurray, where we've done focus groups, and Hannah. There's a sense that the boom times are gone and they're not coming back. So we see it at that level. And we also see it at the individual level for a lot of people who look and see leaders like Naheed Nanshi and previously Rachel Notley that don't look like the leaders that we're used to seeing at the municipal and provincial and federal levels. And the replacement of Stephen Harper, he is an Albertan in many people's minds, regardless of where he was born and raised. Replacement of him with a Laurentian elite in the face of Trudeau, all of these things at the individual, community, and province level have really thrown Albertans into a bit of an identity crisis. And I think that's why we're seeing them lash out through things like separatism and Wexit, and why we've seen some really wonky survey results in recent times.
With the prosperity piece, that's a particularly interesting one for me because, and you kind of alluded, if not stated outright, that it harkens very much back to sort of that American dream. And just with you saying right there, the whole identity crisis piece, that really has my gears kind of turning because, I mean, the idea of prosperity is I think problematic for the reasons that you defined earlier, where it implies that, well, if you're not a raging success in life with three pickup trucks and a big house, then it's your own damn fault because you haven't worked hard enough. And that ignores not only the fact that people come from different starting blocks in life, and certainly, I mean, one of the big examples that I like to go to is, First Nations peoples who are experiencing generational trauma. They're not starting at the same starting block as everybody who hasn't experienced that same trauma. So I'm curious, and I'll make this, I always do really big two-part questions. I'm very bad at that. But I'm curious if the prosperity piece, do you think that's healthy for a society to have as a value? And secondary to that, given the whole American dream component of it too, I'm curious if you think that there's a connection between that ideology and the amount of, frankly, Americanization that we're seeing in a lot of the protests in Alberta right now regarding freedom and whatnot.
That's a big two-part question.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I'll answer the first part about prosperity to say I think things are subtly changing at the cultural level, at the province-wide level, when it comes to our conceptualization of prosperity. So, as part of our focus groups, we've had our participants as the first activity to, and your listeners and viewers can do this, draw me an Albertan. So the idea is that we get them to try to personify what it means to be an Albertan. We have them name them, give them backstories, and the vast majority of our participants in these focus groups will draw somebody who is an oil worker, a farmer, or a cowboy, right? And they normally name them Joe or Al or something like that. Though those that don't draw those types of personalities will ultimately come to consensus with the group that Joe is actually the quintessential Albertan, that politics tend to revolve around that. Okay, so that's a big way of teeing up the first answer to your question. We started asking them, so in those focus groups, we don't ask the participants for their own personal opinions. We ask them, what would Joe do? Right? What would Joe feel? How would Joe react to these certain scenarios? And I'm drawn to one particular activity where we show a picture of a homeless person asking for money on the street. We show them this picture and then we say, how would Joe say that person got there? Okay. Now, if we had an old conceptualization of the way that the quintessential Albertan would behave, this is Martha and Henry. If we'd asked them back in the 1990s, Martha and Henry would have said personal responsibility. They got themselves into that mess. Shouldn't have, picked up the drink or picked up the pipe or whatever else. It's all on them. We were flabbergasted to see that people said, no, Joe's dad might have said that. So Henry, right, might have said that.
Yeah.
But Joe knows people that have fallen on hard times. Joe works on the rigs. He's seen the effects of cocaine. He's seen the effects of meth. He knows that this is a disease. He knows that this is not just a matter of willpower and personal responsibility and hard work. He knows that bad things happen to good people. So what we've seen over the course of a generation, I think, is that average Joe Albertan in our own collective minds has become more global. And it's not because necessarily he's left his community, although many Joes have. It's because the world is coming to him, right? A lot of the folks that are working on the rigs are coming from other parts of Canada, other parts of the world that didn't share that Alberta worldview. So Joe is becoming more accepting of ideas that many people would label progressive. Now, let's not get out of hand here. Joe is not going to take out an NDP membership by any means, according to any of our focus groups. But he has a tinge of libertarianism to him, I think, and a level of compassion and empathy with people that he knows personally. And we know from research in the United States that conservatives tend not to identify with a social issue unless they know people that are personally affected by it. So it's why Republican senators, when they talk about the Me Too movement, will say, I'm totally against sexual harassment and assault because I have a wife and I have a daughter, right? That's the line from them. And progressives often go, well, if you didn't have a wife and a daughter, you wouldn't be able to identify with this.
Yeah,
we know that that's the conservative mentality, and it's, and I'm not being pejorative about it. That's what psychological research shows, and that does manifest itself at the community level as well. So Joe Jr., I think, is a bit more empathetic when it comes to a lot of social issues because he's seen people actually encounter those challenges. COVID-19 is one of them.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's one of the things that I wanted to try to juxtapose with the whole idea of prosperity, because if it's pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps and all of that, there's a whole lot of Albertans who are only in their homes because of programs like CERB, and that flies directly in the face of earned prosperity. Because there are clearly circumstances where things happen that are outside of an individual's or a society's control, and they do require some level of assistance to not drown. So that's an interesting point. I'm curious, how do the people in your initiative or in your focus groups, rather, how do they reconcile those values that they're attributing to Joe with the values that we see from the ruling Conservative Party? The easy example that I'll go to is something as high profile as supervised consumption sites. If people are able to look at the picture of the homeless guy and go, yeah, life happened to him and he got screwed and we should probably help him. There's a big question to me about the UCP's stance on things like addiction, because they are very much it's just a choice, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, even though that flies in all of the evidence on addiction management and treatment. How do the people in your focus groups reconcile those two things, or do they?
So if I could just put a place marker down, I'd like to come back and talk about the dissonance that our participants have for their own personal identities and what they see in Joe, because that's an important part that often gets left out of these conversations. We have a lot of young women of color who still draw Joe, and I'd like to talk about how that is a real amount of political dissonance that needs to be unpacked with our research. The short answer to your question, though, is that most people don't vote in Alberta based on party positions. Okay, and this flies in the face of the way we normally think about elections, and it's not just unique to Alberta. Rather, people tend to vote for parties that share their priorities.
Okay.
So a lot of people don't know what the UCP's position would be on supervised consumption sites. Quite frankly, a lot of people don't think about supervised consumption sites. Okay, there's a very small minority of people, although our recent research shows that about 42% of Albertans have had substance use issues or know somebody that does. So I think that number is growing. But most people don't go in and read a platform the way that you and I do, right? They look for, you know, the slogan and the messaging that say in the last election, this election is all about the economy, jobs, and pipelines. and I'm going to align myself with whatever party shares my priorities. And that worked for the UCP in 2019. Our more recent research shows, though, when the issue landscape shifts in the middle of a pandemic, as much as the party tries to make it about livelihoods and lives, we're seeing that a lot of people are putting lives ahead of livelihoods in their own set of priorities. And that has detrimental effects for parties that want to keep the channel tuned on the economy, which is why we're seeing the UCP reach out for any conversation other than healthcare and to talk about the carbon tax, for example. So, Nate, I wonder if it's okay if I go back now and just talk about the dissonance
Absolutely.
that these people have, because I'm reminded of one experience we had when we did a focus group at McEwen University, and there were a pair of women in the classroom that were sitting on opposite ends of the classroom, but they drew the same Joe. And so I asked them, who is this Joe? Like, you guys send a lot of detail on this person, right down to, you know, their plaid jacket and what kind of beer they drink and everything else. And both of them said independently at the same time, "That's my dad." And I said, "Oh, that's interesting. So your dad's from Alberta?" "Yeah." "I don't presume to think that you have a mom, but if you have a mom, is she from Alberta?" "Oh, yeah." I said, "Well, why didn't you draw your mom?" "Well, you said Albertan. And the first thing that comes to my mind is my dad, a man." And we see this in all of these drawings that we have. There are very few people of color. Only, I think, out of all of these focus groups in 32 different communities, two or three Indigenous people that were drawn. And we know we have Indigenous people in our focus groups. We know we have women. We know we have people of color. And yet they're not drawing themselves as a quintessential Albertan. There's a dissonance there that we're looking to unpack with our future research. And we're going to start by going into schools. We're hoping to get funded this coming week to do a study where we have young Albertans in elementary and high school start to draw Albertans for us. We're going to try to figure out at what point in a youth's own identity development do they start to identify the cowboy as what it means to be Albertan? And what does that tell us about how they see themselves in this political system? If they don't look like that, what's their relationship to politics?
Yeah, I was gonna. I'm glad you kind of hit on the color thing, because that was one of my next questions, is what color is Joe? But it sounds like from what you just said there that the Joe is overwhelmingly white.
Yeah, every single one of the consensus drawings, we ask our focus groups to choose one of the personalities that is the quintessential Albertan. Every single one of them was a middle-aged white man. And about over 90, I have to go back to my numbers here, but I can certainly say with confidence, over 90% of the overall drawings that everybody drew, no matter who they were, progressive, conservative, rural, urban, people of color, white stream, whoever, they were drawing middle-aged white.
Interesting. That's fascinating to me, because I don't know what the percentages are, but there's, to me, fundamentally a whole lot more to Alberta than just middle-aged white men, says the middle-aged white man. But
Well, it's true,
that's
but this is about the stories we tell ourselves, right? And if we keep telling ourselves that that is what it means to be Albertan, even if we don't agree with that, right? And we had a lot of our participants go, "Oh, do you really want me to draw what I think an Albertan is, or do you want me to, you know, think through it and draw somebody that's from a community of color, for example?" I said, "What popped to your mind? Because that's what we really want to examine." And we've had a lot of conversations with people across the province saying, at what point do we start to reject that myth as being completely out of step with the way that the community actually is? And that, from our research shows, that's when we start to see culture shift, is when enough anomalies start to build up in people's minds, and they have enough cognitive dissonance with that image of what it means to be Albertan. That's when we start to see people change, because the attitudes are there. The attitudes for supporting a progressive party, we've seen it in survey after survey over the last decade. When it comes to policy positions, conservative parties, for the most part, have been out of step with the median Albertan voter. But Joe, the average Joe in our minds, is not the median Alberta voter, right? And that's what's so fascinating about our research.
So would a great way to throw a wrench in the next provincial election be for just all of the parties to include the word conservative in their names and talk about jobs, economy, pipeline? Because like hearing you say that, it seems to me that like if the defining characteristics for what drives the average Joe to vote is that perception, if every political party in Alberta just threw the name conservative on their title, I do you think that would have, like, I know it's a ridiculous proposition,
Well, it's
but I'm
not.
curious.
It's not. And so I remember having lunch with then former Premier Notley about a couple months after the 2019 campaign. We were meeting about something else to do with our policy school. She was going to come in and be a speaker and so on. And she just asked me flat out, like, what do you think happened in 2019 that didn't happen in 2015 for us? And I said, well, to be frank, in 2015, you talked about prosperity for all, shared prosperity. That was actually on your on signs and everything. It was in all of your speeches. Prosperity is a code word in Alberta politics, along with concepts of freedom, autonomy, Alberta First, Alberta Advantage. These are buzzwords that resonate with people. They're part of what they think it means to be Albertan. So, but she spun it into prosperity for all, shared prosperity. And she got away from that message entirely in 2019. We looked through their campaign materials. I went through and did a media scan, and the word prosperity didn't appear maybe two or three times in anything that we saw coming out of the leader's mouth. So you say, can they rename themselves conservatives? Not likely, although I hear rumblings that the New Democrats may be trying to run away from the NDP brand because NDP, I think, is the reverse of a code word in Alberta politics. It's toxic. So a renaming or rebranding to the Democratic Party of Alberta or something like that might be the kind of shift that people need to get out of that mentality that the NDP is, un-Albertan, which they've been framed that way since the 1950s.
Well, and that's the interesting thing about that to me, just off the cuff here, is a lot of people associate the provincial NDP very, very heavily with the federal NDP. And so were they to rebrand to something separate from that, I think that would probably resonate with the people who value that autonomy, Alberta first stuff.
Yeah, I think that's shifting. So first of all, like we're seeing differences in people's attitudes towards Jagmeet Singh versus Rachel Notley. She's far more popular.
Oh, yeah.
We're also seeing now Alberta catching up with the rest of the West, where federal Liberal voters are voting NDP provincially. So people are able to, there's been all kinds of research on this, are able to somehow make sense of the NDP Liberals split federally and provincially. So I think Alberta is catching up into the rest of the West in that sense. So yeah, I wouldn't make too much about at least the available voters for the NDP provincially, I think are already able to make that distinction between the federal brand and the provincial brand.
That kind of covers off the definition of conservatism. That Joe piece is fascinating to me. But the other thing that I definitely want to talk about today is the Common Ground Initiative, which, by the way, I think is a fantastic name. And I don't just say that because 20 years ago I played in a punk band called Common Ground. What is the Common Ground Initiative?
It's a multi-method, multidisciplinary research project that brings together over a dozen U of A social scientists to study what it is that make up the common values of Alberta society. So it's examining Alberta's political culture, the underlying values that define what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in our society. At this point, we're collecting information on those common values are. We're using personification techniques, like I told you about drawing the average Albertan and so on. And the second stage of our research, we'll start to unpack the implications of that. What does it mean that we all draw middle-aged white guys in cowboy hats? What does it mean that our collective identity looks like that, and yet our personal identity is completely different? Does that help us to explain, for example, why Albertans tend to turn out to the polls at far, far lower numbers? They tend to be disengaged from politics more than others. What does it tell us about the prevalence of settler colonialism in this province, where we see ourselves as a bunch of, cowboys who, as we know from the tale, were part of the genocide against Indigenous people in this region, right? So that's going to be the next part of our project. But we're doing focus groups, we're doing online surveys, we're going around and embedding ourselves in coffee klatches, meeting up with people at their regular, 10 a.m. coffee meetings at the Chicken Delight or Tim Hortons or wherever it is, trying to get a better understanding of what are the common values that tend to unite Albertans, whether they see themselves as being progressive or conservative.
And you released some data today, and because it's probably going to take me a couple of days to edit this, I just want to be clear with our audience that we're recording this on December 16th, so Wednesday. Shift work messes with your calendar. But you released some interesting data today in regards to what those issues are. So for our audience, can you walk through sort of what does that data show?
Well, our most recent survey was in August 2020, so right at the end of the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we compared what we saw in August 2020 with what we saw from a post-federal election survey in November of 2019. So that was just weeks before the pandemic hit. So we're trying to see what effect that first wave of the pandemic had on party support and leader support in the province. I mean, some of the high-level findings that we have, you can go to commongroundpolitics.ca for the highlights, for the more in-depth details. But we found that all leaders, provincial and federal, did tend to increase in terms of their popularity. They all went from being what we call underwater, below 50% approval rating, to above 50% approval rating. That was true across the board. The biggest increase that we saw was for the prime minister, who went from the least popular at about 37 on the feeling thermometer to the most popular at 51. So 51, just barely more popular than unpopular. And he joined Rachel Notley at 51 as our two most popular federal and provincial leaders. Jason Kenney grew over this time, which is interesting because a lot of the recent talk about the UCP's drop in fortunes is attributed to Jason Kenney's lack of leadership. Jason Kenney, over this first wave of the pandemic, was actually increased his popularity, according to our research. So his more recent decline, according to Angus Reid polling, suggests that the party's fortunes may have fallen even more. But over this period, we noted that UCP support fell by about 8 points. And in the rest of our research brief, we try to unpack why it was that they lost those 8 points over those 9 months, when it didn't seem to have much to do with Jason Kenney. They bled most of their support to the Wild Rose Independence Party, which shouldn't be surprising, which points to the fact that, you know, people within the UCP that are worried about their rural right flank probably have reason to be. And we attributed a lot of the shift to, as I mentioned before, a shift in Albertans' priorities. If they were all about economies, pipelines, and jobs in May 2019 during the election, and they seem to be, as we've seen the pandemic push healthcare further up the issue landscape, they tend to shy away from the party that owns the economic issue. So that helps us to explain at least a bit of the UCP's drop in support.
Where are the areas that people care about?
Well, still, economy is still the number one issue to Albertans as of August 2020. Now, we're hoping to get back into the field again in February to see whether that's still the case. But the economy dropped about 8 points in terms of people's most preferred or most important issue to them in Alberta politics. And healthcare increased by about 6.5%. They're still within about 5 percentage points of one another, but people still do tend to favor economy over social issues, which explains why the UCP still has a lead over the NDP by about that same margin.
Okay. I'm just looking at the graphic here. And I know I'm asking you to wildly speculate, but do you think that we're going to see those healthcare numbers increase? I mean, if those numbers increased after the first wave, where things were bad, but they weren't anywhere near as bad as we're seeing them right now. To me, that there's a whole lot of, not to say that it would ever eclipse jobs, economy, pipelines. Well, jobs and economy anyways. Do you see that health number growing at all with the amount of attention that healthcare is getting, particularly with the vaccination efforts that we're seeing right now?
Likely. Again, we don't have data, but if we know anything about Albertans, if an issue tends to impact them directly or people around them, they tend to notice, like most voters. So I would imagine that healthcare has probably taken a bit of an increase as well. I'd note in that research, we didn't get into this in the research brief, but civil rights also jumped quite a bit in terms of people's number one priority. And I would expect that particularly people on the rural right would view their own personal freedoms and charter rights as being the most important issue as well, which helps us to explain why some of those votes shifted over from the UCP to the Wild Rose Independence Party, particularly in southern and rural Alberta. The other thing to keep in mind, you know, this is that, you know, we're still 2 years out from an election. So, if we're still grappling with the public health effects of the pandemic come the next provincial election in fall 2023, then that opens up some space for the NDP to make gains the way that they did in 2015. Now, the other key piece of 2015, though, which is the history of voting in all of Western Canada, conservative parties don't have to worry about progressive parties unless they start to split their own base, right? So it's been true in BC, Saskatchewan, and Alberta now that the conservatives win unless they end up fracturing into these splinter parties. So the thing to watch, I think, over the next year and a half or so is not necessarily whether healthcare brings some people across the great divide from the UCP to the NDP, but rather whether the civil rights issue and the economy even and lack of economic growth tended to splinter votes off to this Wild Rose Independence Party. Now, if you're a UCP supporter, you can hope by 2023 the economic recovery has begun and you can change the narrative around jobs from being losses of jobs to huge gains in jobs.
One other thing I'd like to get your take on, because you really got my gears turning with the whole prosperity American dream bit. We're definitely seeing, at least on the fringe minority, I'll say, a Americanization of Alberta politics. And I would argue that in some ways we're seeing it in the mainstream as well. Jason Kenney's made multiple trips to the States where he's posed for American conservative politicians, Ted Cruz. But we're also seeing at the and this kind of comes into play with the civic rights that you were talking about. It seems like there's a lot more American stuff that's rolling into that. At the rally that occurred in Calgary last Saturday, there were "Don't Tread on Me" flags. There were Trump stickers. People were talking about freedom of speech, which still blows my mind because that's not a thing in Canada. How much do you think? How careful do you think governing political parties need to be with playing with that? Because we're kind of seeing, I think in the States, sort of where if you double down on those ideas over and over and over again without any kind of restraint, we're kind of seeing where that leads. Do you think that Alberta politicians, especially Alberta conservative politicians, need to pay a little bit more attention to what the end results of those are? Because we're certainly starting to see some creep happen in Alberta.
Well, a couple of things. First, it's not new.
Okay.
Alberta earned the reputation as being the Texas of the North for a while, for a long while. Not just because of our petro politics, but because one of the founding white settler groups tended to be from the United States. So we have a long history of that going back a century. I'd also say though that we're seeing global impacts on this movement as well, right? So you'll remember back about a year and a half ago, we saw yellow vest movements, yellow vest protests that morphed into the caravans that we saw going to the United States. So it's not just American. In our research, survey research shows that it's only a fringe minority of Albertans that admire Donald Trump in any way. So if you're looking for a silver lining, most people reject that as reject Trumpism as being
I'll take that as a silver lining.
at least socially unacceptable. And that's reinforced by our focus groups, because we ask people, the Joe that you chose, the average Joe Albertan that you all identified as being the quintessential member of our community, how does he feel about Donald Trump? And there were some groups that say, oh yeah, no, he'd wear a Trump, he'd put a Trump bumper sticker on, and he'd be wearing the Make Alberta Great Again hat. But interestingly enough, those happened in Calgary. When we went to Fort Mac, they all said, no, Joe doesn't believe in that. For the most part, I think mainstream Albertans, as I said before, seem rather disconnected from politics. And we may be having a moment now with the COVID-19 pandemic where people are actually influenced by the decisions that their politicians make. And you've seen on your Twitter feed as much as I have, people having buyer's remorse for voting conservative, for example, the way that some people did have voter's remorse for voting for the NDP. But for the most part, I think Albertans are rather disengaged from politics. And again, I keep coming back to this. I think it's because a lot of Albertans don't see themselves as being part of that mainstream political community. And I hope our research shines some light on this to suggest, the mainstream that you're seeing is not the actual like the way that Albertans think and the way that Albertans look.
Yeah.
And maybe we're having a cultural moment now where we can actually ask those questions.
I'm curious if your research is going to include, or if it already does include, questions like, how do we make Joe look more for the visible minorities and the BIPOC folks that are doing these drawings? I'm curious if your research includes the question, how do we make Joe look more like you?
That's where we're going in the second phase. And I know a lot of people get frustrated by this, by saying that, well, you're seeking common ground when we should be, you know, cultivating polarization. I think it's important, honestly, this is to my core. I think it's important to figure out how the system works currently, right? How people view themselves and view their political community before we can start seriously asking questions of how to shift that in a more positive and inclusive way. I mean, that's a political, that moves us out of, I think, empirical political science and more into political activism. So we're going to be bringing on a lot of community groups that are interested in depolarizing Alberta politics, for example, and then a lot of folks that are committed to improving equity, diversity, and inclusion in our society, because we've got a long way to go. You've seen the assaults that are happening in Edmonton on Muslim women, Black Muslim women. We got a long way to go that way. And part of that, I think, is we have to push away this myth that you know, we are an understanding multicultural society that still is able to somehow draw Joe, right? There's a disconnect there. And I hope that when we do this research 10 years from now, we'll start to see people drawing different people, right? And seeing themselves and seeing other people as being part of what it means to be Alberta.
I'm curious, did anyone pull a bit of a Jason Kenney and reject the premise of the question? Because I have to, like, when you first said you asked people to draw a Joe, I immediately experienced brain lock because I... yeah, to boil down a province as complex as Alberta to, you know, one figure, I don't know that I could do that, but I'm curious if anybody in the focus groups was like, that's not possible.
Well, and just to be clear, the prompt is, draw me an Albertan, right? And then you're right. People go, wait a minute. You're paying me $75 to sit here for the draw. First of all, that's their first reaction. You know, then their next reaction is looking over to what other people are drawing and say, well, you can look over if you want, this is a group activity, but I'd like you just to focus on what popped into your mind when I said that, draw me an Albertan. And for, there were people like you, Nate, that drew, you know, a person in khakis and a dress shirt in downtown Calgary. There were people that drew that. But they were in the very, very small minority. Most people have a pretty good idea, no matter what their background is, no matter what their political leanings are. They have a pretty good idea of what it means to be Albertan, and it doesn't look like them.
That's profoundly tragic to me. Yeah, that's.
But we're recognizing it, right?
Which is
and
good.
That's what this research is doing. We're pointing this dissonance out, because if we do want to make Alberta more inclusive. Community, which most of us, I think, most opinion polls show most of us do want, right?
Yeah.
Then I think the first thing to do, and pardon the pun, and I'm not playing off of Jim Prentice here in any way, we have to turn the mirror on ourselves, right? And say, we have these preconceived notions of what, not just Joe, it's not just who's the quintessential Albertan, but it's what Joe means and does to our own attitudes and our own behavior. So if we think Joe is out there and Joe's the most influential Albertan, it tells us if Joe doesn't like a PST, then why would I raise it, right? Why would I stick my neck out at a public meeting if that's the case? If Joe is a conservative, big C conservative, which most Joes weren't, they didn't belong to a political party. But what does that tell me about my chances of, you know, supporting my local NDP or Green or Wild Rose even? Party when it's not going to matter, right? So it's what Joe does to our own thinking, right? It creates a sense that there is no alternative but to go along with what Joe wants because, you know, he's going to win out anyway. He always has. And I don't mean that to come around as being defeatist. I don't mean that at all. But that's what culture does to us. It creates boundaries of acceptability, political correctness in a way, that I think it's time that we start to recognize, point out first, if we're ever going to reverse it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I would be dishonest if I didn't say that that whole part of the conversation has left me with a bit of a sick feeling in my stomach, because to me it's if anybody was going to ask what somebody would think an Albertan should look like, it's heartbreaking to me that anybody wouldn't just draw themselves.
Yeah, and then we're going to be going into other provinces to figure out whether this is just an Alberta phenomenon, right? But we've done some pilots in other provinces, and we asked them to draw in Alberta. I just did it with a group of students from Newfoundland and Labrador, and they drew the same thing that we drew. And maybe Alberta is unique in that way, and maybe it has to do with Alberta's exceptionalism that I talked about earlier, right?
Yeah.
That Albertans have this well-defined sense of what it means to be Albertan in a way that, you know, if I went into Ontario and asked, draw an Ontarian, what would they draw? Right? Draw a Manitoban. I'm from Manitoba. I don't know. Probably draw somebody with a Jets hat standing on a hill next to a river. I don't know. Drinking a Slurpee and swatting a mosquito. I don't know. But I think that other political cultures across Canada are probably less homogenous than Alberta. But that's something that we have to test with further research.
Interesting. Wow, this is I have to say that piece of the conversation has probably surprised me more than any interview that I've done so far. That's just I'm going to be processing that for a few days. So thank you for that. Yeah, that's jammed me up pretty good. Is there anything else about sort of the work that you've done on defining conservatism in Alberta, or about the work that you're doing with the Common Ground Initiative that you'd like people to know?
Yeah, I think I'd just close with me. I'm sorry I shook you up, but I think
It doesn't
Albertans need to
happen
be
very
shaken up.
often, but that's just rattled
You
me.
know, but I think Albertans need to be shaken up. And I think Canadians do as well. There's been a lot of research that talks about how the stories we tell ourselves about what it means to be Canadian can often paper over a lot of inequality. The big one is being a Canadian is, you know, fill in the blanks of this sentence. When it comes to multiculturalism, Americans are a blank while Canada is a blank. And most of my students will be able to parrot back, the US is a melting pot and Canada is a
Mosaic.
mosaic, right?
Yeah.
This mosaic myth has helped to paper over a lot of inequality. And it's a story we tell ourselves that we're an inclusive community when there is a lot of inequality still left in this country. Yes, we've come a long way. And yes, I'm not going to be, I'm not, you know, saying I don't want to live in Canada. Canada is the best place in the world for a person like me to live, right? But I think we have to constantly revisit the stories we tell ourselves. And what we're trying to do through Common Ground is to show people how we see ourselves as a community and compare that with who we are as individuals. And if there's a mismatch there, then maybe it's time we start looking at what our community values are.
I would like to think that, I mean, to my perception, I don't think that Canada can effectively call itself a functioning mosaic right now, simply because of the examples that you just cited, where people are being randomly attacked for no reason other than their faith and their skin color. Obviously, that mosaic is not working. But the idea of Canada that I love is the notion that that's what the majority of us are trying to work towards. We're not there yet, and like you said, I think it's critical that we acknowledge that. But I would much rather be in a country that's trying to be a mosaic than a country that's trying to melt things together.
Well, and that's a good way to look at it. I hope that a lot of Canadians do look at it as a process, right? And especially when we talk about processes like reconciliation, it's not something that happens with an apology in the House of Commons. It's not something that happens when we write down on our social studies test that we know that Canada is a mosaic. It's a process, an ongoing process. And I hope our research helps to shed light on how well we're doing in that process.
I really want to thank you again for coming on and being as generous with your time as you have been. I want to thank you for shaking me up as much as you did, because I think that, you know, I like to think that I try to pay attention to things, and the fact that that floored me as much as it did, that only reinforces to me how many more people need to hear that, that's how Albertans are identifying. And I don't want to mess with your results in the future, but for anybody who's listening to this podcast who finds themselves in one of Dr. Wesley's study groups, please draw yourself.
That's our worry, right? That's why we're moving on from Alberta very shortly. I just want to say thanks for allowing folks that are doing important academic research like this to come on and explain it to people. It's so important that people realize what it is that we do in the academy that tries to lend back to society. We're not doing a good job ourselves as a lot of faculty members in explaining that to people, but especially in times like this, when governments are taking a hard look at what they're spending on, I hope people take a look at research projects like ours and many other dozens that are happening in the faculty arts at the University of Alberta as being worthwhile. So thank you.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. Now, we want to just take a quick sec to remind you that we're only able to produce the kind of content that we do because of the support that we receive from our Patreon supporters. So if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, please consider signing up to be one of our Patreon supporters at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab. And if you're listening to the audio version of our podcast, please consider leaving a rating and a review, because it's those things that help us to get the podcast in front of more and more people. And as always, thank you very much for your time.